It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Morning.
No Maria this morning?
No, she's rushing in to get her taxes done.
Yeah.
Oops. All right. Wait.
let's start out, as we always do, with local and a city council vote that's coming up this Monday that we've been talking about.
Yeah, we've been talking for the last few weeks about Tim Burgess' proposed ordinance on quote-unquote aggressive panhandling, an ordinance that basically would allow police officers to issue citations to people who have received complaints or been observed by the officer to be engaged in quote-unquote aggressive panhandling, which has a very, very odd and vague definition, particularly around pay stations and ATMs and so forth. And, you know, there have been a number of reports on a number of expressed concerns. The Seattle Human Rights Commission came out with a very good report talking about, you know, look, if you issue citations to these folks or additional citations, because actual aggressive behavior is already illegal under the law, but if you have an increase in these citations for people who are, you know, by and large homeless and certainly all poor, you know, many of them are likely to not appear in court or not pay the fines. They wind up having warrants issued. They wind up landing in jail and wind up not being able to get public services or housing or jobs because they have an arrest record. And, you know, it's a snowball effect and doesn't really solve a problem because unless you're the Downtown Seattle Association, which is the trade group of big downtown merchants that has been pushing this and thinks it's a swell idea because it's easier to have a public relations gesture around this than it is to have a public relations gesture around easier traffic or cheaper parking downtown for people who want to come from the suburbs to shop. You know, it doesn't really solve a problem, and it's a public relations gesture that is done at the expense, once again, of bashing the poor, and particularly bashing the homeless. So these are the arguments for it. The council is planning to have a vote on Monday on this ordinance. It was passed out of committee last week, 3-1. No surprises there. The latest head count is that the nine council members are expected to vote yes on it. And Mayor McGinn has been making noises about potentially vetoing this measure. If he does, it would take six council votes to override it. So if even one of those votes on council can be flipped, it makes it much more likely that McGinn will veto the measure, and of course, more likely still that the veto would then be upheld. And of course, if two votes are flipped, then the measure fails, and McGinn doesn't even have to veto it. So people who are service providers, in particular, who are trying to get this stopped, are asking that people call their city congressman this weekend or first thing Monday morning when they're back in their offices. Please do it. In particular, Mike O'Brien, the new former Sierra Club president, who is now on city council, who's very close to McGinn and who campaigned and said in his campaign that he opposed this measure, is now saying he's going to vote for it, and he's considered the most likely of the six to actually flip. Tom Rasmussen is also getting a lot of attention and a lot of love from people hoping that he will change his vote because he's expressed some misgivings as well. Bruce Harrell could stand to hear from people. But O'Brien seems particularly to be the key vote on this. So if people have a chance sometimes over the weekend, leave a message or call up Monday morning and be polite, be firm, and tell them what you think of this measure. And there's plenty of resources online for people who want to find out more about it. SLOG, the Stranger's blog, has written quite a bit about this issue. As I said, the Seattle Human Rights Commission came out with a very good report that lays out pretty clearly all the different problems with it, and hopefully it won't pass. Or if it does pass, it'll be vetoed by Mayor McGinn.
All right. Moving on, as you had noted in last week's events, last Saturday, there was a immigrant rights rally here in the city.
Yes, there was, and it was very instructive this week to contrast the difference in coverage that our one remaining local daily newspaper of record gave the immigrant rights rally on Saturday with the coverage that it gave ad nauseum of the Tea Party rallies on Tax Day on Thursday. Now, the immigrant rights March, by the estimate of organizers and a lot of observers, probably had about 7,000 or 8,000 people down in Occidental Square. It's a pretty large rally. The Tea Party on Thursday, the protest in Seattle drew several hundred, according to the estimates, and there were another 3,000 or so in Olympia as well. Now, both of these were part of larger national days of protests. Of course, the Tea Party protests happening all over the country and got a lot of big national news. The immigrant rights was also part of a national day of protests, and there were other demonstrations around the state and around the country on that as well, including a very big one in Washington, D.C. Now, the interesting thing about the Seattle Times coverage of this is that you would have thought from the coverage that it was the Tea Party one that had 10 times as many people in Seattle as the immigrant rights one, by the full color photo above the fold, the huge banner headline, the three reporters assigned to cover the story, and then the constantly updated on the website versions of the story over the next 24 hours as the story apparently continued to break that people had, you know, first come to the rally and then gone home. The immigrant rights protest story in the Times was fairly perfunctory. It had the usual trope that is inevitable in the Seattle Times story on an immigrant rights rally, which is that it had to mention that there were people there carrying Mexican flags, not mentioning, of course, that there were far many more people there carrying American flags, but mentioned plenty of people in the Tea Party rally carrying American flags, of course, and being patriotic. That was mentioned several times. But the contrast between how the two were covered in the paper was very instructive. But interestingly enough, there was another story this week in the New York Times with a poll that came out that looked at the composition and the beliefs of people who self-identify as being part of the Tea Party movement that maybe tells us a lot about why the Seattle Times gives the disproportionate coverage to it they want. What we found out from the New York Times poll was that the composition of the Tea Party movement is basically a bunch of older, angry, generally fairly well-off white guys. It's male, it's white, it's middle and upper income people, and they're very, very angry. Well, what are they angry about? Well, in part, it is their perception that the government is picking on the wealthy and giving too much to poor people, read black people. Yes, it's about race. It was actually very explicit in the poll that one of the things that not everyone in the Tea Party, of course, but certainly a huge number of people, you know, we have a president who doesn't look like them, and it's really disturbing a lot of people. Now there's a class element to this, of course, too, but, you know, when you have a president who comes from Harvard Law School, you really can't get much more establishment than that. It's not like Obama isn't establishment. He is. And it's not like he isn't wealthy. He is, although he wasn't born into wealth. You know, the real issue here is race, and the issue is that Obama is perceived as caring more about poor people than he cares about them. So what can we draw with this in regards to the New York Times? Well, the lesson is that if you're an old, angry, well-off white guy, then Frank Bluffin can relate to you. Now, I wonder why it is that he can relate to you, but more to the point, if you're not an older, angry, well-off white guy, which is probably the majority of the people listening to this program, why are you giving Frank Bluffin your money, and isn't it time that you stopped subscribing to the Seattle Times and got your news from other online sources and other newspapers that actually have news in them? Just saying.
All right. Moving on to national and the Fed's looking at handing out some charges coming up.
Yeah, I should say parenthetical to this, we have a number of stories in the national and international segment of the news program this week, as we do each week. And I think in the 14 or so years we've been doing this, this is actually the first time that every one of the stories can be qualified as, in one way or another, as good news. This just doesn't happen. This is really bizarre. I mean, it's kind of a Twilight Zone kind of episode. I'm waiting for, you know, Rod Serling and the music.
Yeah, mark this day on your calendar because it's never going to occur again.
Well, one would hope that it would, actually, but, well, let's just say the track record's not, you know, not encouraging.
Right.
The Securities and Exchange Commission yesterday filed suit against Goldman Sachs and we've talked about this, and Maria's talked about this a lot in this program, of course, various derivatives products and subprime mortgage products that Goldman Sachs and many other financial houses were putting out during the housing bubble. They were charging Goldman Sachs in particular with one of about 20 securities products, financial products that was put out that bet against the housing bubble, and that the client who helped create this product specifically selected securities that he thought would be good bets to fail, and then in the belief that they thought that that this product would fail, according to the Securities and Exchange Commission, Goldman Sachs designed this product to fail and then sold it to investors without disclosing that knowledge. So Goldman Sachs is charged with fraud on this. Now, Goldman Sachs has very good lawyers, not to mention they don't necessarily have friends in high places so much as they have plants in high places. But so, you know, as with the Bank of America, which is another case that we've talked about where the SEC went after them and the punishment wound up being a slap on the wrist, you know, who knows how the legal process will come out on this. But Goldman Sachs has already taken a hit on it because their stock was off more than 10% in value by the close of day yesterday, 13% in fact, and it lost over $10 billion in market value just in yesterday's trading alone. So Goldman Sachs has already taken a hit on this just in one day's trading that probably far exceeded the amount of money that they actually made off of that particular trade. And according anyway to the New York Times, which is you know, sort of they and the Wall Street Journal are kind of the hometown papers of Wall Street. The SEC may be looking at any number of other financial products, not just at Goldman Sachs, but a number of the big investment banks to pursue charges against in the future. This may just be the beginning of the beginning of the opening of the door on this particular issue. And while we're on the topic of accountability, also yesterday, the federal government, in this case, the Department of Justice, and you can be fairly sure that the SEC did not move on Goldman Sachs without clearing it with the Obama administration first, just because, you know, something that politically charged is not going to be done in a vacuum. Similarly, five former executives, including the former president of Blackwater International, called before the carpet by the Department of Justice on charges of weapons smuggling and also lying to investigators around the weapons smuggling. And there's also additional investigations going on around potentially bribing foreign officials, bribing them by, in the case of Jordanian officials they were trying to get a contract with, giving them very high-priced, expensive weapons. And, of course, those weapons cannot legally be exported either. So Blackwater's starting to be in all kinds of trouble at this point. And then there was also some interesting stories in the New York Times. You see a theme here. The Seattle Times does not report this, but the national papers do. And also the Washington Post. The Post reporting yesterday that a top CIA lawyer has been given immunity in the 2005 case. If you remember this, going back to the Bush administration when all of the various tapes that were made of torture sessions at Guantanamo were destroyed by the CIA. A CIA lawyer has been given immunity in exchange for his testimony in that case. And the New York Times report this week also saying that then-CIA Director Porter Goss not only approved of the destruction of those tapes, but he made jokes about it with a superior. So we may be seeing some action coming up in that case as well. So after a year plus of the Obama administration really doing a very poor job of holding any of the excesses of the Bush era to to account for their depredations and saying, yeah, we just need to look forward and move along and ignore the fact that the most powerful people in this country for 8 years brazenly broke the law. It's starting to look like there might, at least here and there, be inexplicable outbreaks of accountability, which is all to the very good.
All right, we'll have to see if that continues. Moving on, there's a debate beginning this week about financial reform.
Yeah, proposals in the House and the Senate that the Democrats are putting forward around financial reform in regard to the housing bubble and the securities and derivatives products that were on the market and the economic meltdown of the past year and a half. This is something that has been long awaited and that, of course, we've talked about a lot in this show also. The Republicans had been planning to approach this the way they approached health care reform, the way they approached most congressional initiatives in the last year plus of the Obama administration, which is to just say no, to try and obstruct it. Well, a report in The Hill came out this week. The Republicans aren't going to be able to block financial reform in the Senate as they've been planned to because they won't be able to get 41 votes to filibuster. Republican Susan Collins of Maine refusing to sign on to a letter that other Republican senators had signed on to pledging to block to filibuster to block the financial reform. Of course, the Republicans are in a very difficult position politically in this one because they're trying to make the case, and I love this. This is pollster-approved spin here. They're objecting to the financial reform measures because, quote unquote, they're not strong enough, and as such, they're bailing out the banks. They're trying to appeal to populist anger against the banks by saying, well, we can't have reform because it's not strong enough, so we'd rather have none at all. And of course, at the same time, they're going back to the banks and trying to fundraise like mad in order to block the reform entirely. So they're trying to have it both ways on this issue, and it doesn't look like they're going to be able to succeed because they won't have the votes to block the reform. Now, as Maria has talked about and we've talked about on this show, the reform isn't all that it should be. It never is, of course, but it certainly would be some major steps in the right direction. And it looks like it's that much more likely this week than last that it will succeed. But we'll know a lot more about that by this time next week.
All right. Moving on, the Obama administration making an announcement this week about hospitals.
Yeah, this is an executive order that came out about the from the Obama administration this week, and also in the good news department and in the department of all the frustrations around Obama's presidency so far, these are the sorts of quiet things that there have been progress on. He issues an executive order saying that for hospitals that receive federal aid or federal funding, which, you know, given Medicare and Medicaid is basically all of them, that they have to allow gay and lesbian partners of patients access to people in the hospital. They have to be able to respect powers of attorney and the other rights that would basically accrue to heterosexual married couples have to accrue to gay and lesbian couples as well. A very welcome breakthrough. Of course, this raises an obvious question, which is, since this is obviously an infringement on states' rights, will be Rob McKenna be suing to have Washington State opt out of it? It would be it clearly would play to his base. So we're looking forward to that lawsuit any day now.
All right. Keep your eyes peeled for that press release.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Florida, there was a special election there this week.
Yeah, and this circles back to the whole differential that I was talking about earlier in the media coverage given to Tea Party demonstrations. Florida had a special election for Congress this week. It was a House seat formerly held by Robert Wexler, who made something of a name for himself in years past by being one of the first congressional representatives to aggressively call for the impeachment of President Bush. He stepped down to move and take a position with a think tank, and there was a special election that was held this week to fill his seat. Now, this is in South Florida. It's a heavily Democratic district. It's roughly analogous to the Senate seat that Scott Brown, the Republican, won late last year. And this is the first election that's been held since then. So there's this whole narrative of heavily Democratic constituency. Will the great Tea Party revolution and the Republican wave and the anti-Obama sentiment propel another Republican victory, or at least make it close? And, well, the answer is no, it didn't. The Democrat in their waist won with 63% of the vote, which is roughly 62% of the vote, excuse me, which is relatively close to the 65% that Obama won in the same district in 2008. So he's more or less in the same ballpark. So it was a huge non-story, whereas if the Republicans had done well in the election, that would have told us a lot of how much the momentum the Republicans have, how well they're going to do this September, yada yada. You can just imagine all of the coverage that story would have gotten. But the fact that the Democrat did just about how you would expect Democrats to do, and that there wasn't this giant Republican wave, it's therefore a non-story. And we still have all the stories coming out about how massive and populist the Tea Party is and how well the Republicans are going to do come this fall, just as though the election in Florida that happened early this week never happened at all. The issue here isn't that the Democrat is in this race is particularly good shakes, or that it's particularly good news or anything like that. It's the differential in media coverage that's given when one side versus the other side does well. It really is a remarkable double standard.
All right. Moving on then to international. And last week you reported on a oil tanker that had run aground in the coral reefs in Australia. Is that right?
Yeah, the Shenning 1 is a Chinese-owned oil tanker that had gone way outside its shipping lane and barreled into maybe that's a bad pun, barreled into a coral reef formation in the Great Barrier Reef, and they were concerned about having 800 tons of heavy engine oil that was on board being leaked into the already fragile coral reefs, which, of course, are under a great deal of stress anyway due to climate change. Well, the good news on that is that they managed to evacuate the tanker and lift it out of harm's way. They had been concerned that it would sink and spill the rest of the oil. That did not happen. So what could have been a major environmental disaster turned out to be instead only a minor environmental disaster. But again, very much of a warning. And the controversy down there around this has been that there was no pilot on board the ship, the Chinese-owned ship, and that there had been pressure put by the Australian government, because it was international waters, to require those a pilot through those shipping lanes, a very environmentally sensitive area, World Heritage Site, etc., but that the shipping companies and oil companies have been fighting this, and it's very reminiscent of the struggle that's gone on for here for many years to require tugboats going through the Straits of Juan de Fuca, the area off Cape Flattery, which can be a very hazardous shipping lane for the tankers coming down from Alaska to the refinery in Anacortes. And that, again, extremely environmentally fragile and sensitive area, Puget Sound, just recovering from a number of environmental stresses from all of us who live here. And this should be a warning for us as well. But, of course, nobody seems to be drawing that parallel just yet.
Mm. And there's still fighting the Exxon Valdez in court, the whole recovery and financial.
Are they? I thought most of that award had been voided.
I believe the bulk of it has, but I think they're still
trying to collect on the rest of it.
I believe
wouldn't surprise me at all, because all right. Exxon Mobil is such an upstanding corporate citizen.
All right, moving on. Finally,
they can give as much money to political campaigns as they want to give now.
It's great that they've removed that for them. Moving on, there was the Obama administration had a summit this week that got a lot of play on the corporate media.
Yeah, and this was this is around nuclear issues, and it is in advance of a UN session that's going to be opening in a couple of weeks in New York City, and will run for most of the month of May. Every 5 years or so, the UN has a review conference around the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that both nuclear and non-nuclear powers participate in. The NNPT, originally drawn up in the late 60s, and it was drawn up with the idea that non-nuclear powers would not become nuclear powers, and then nuclear powers would pledge to rid themselves of nuclear weapons. So the United States has actually been on the books since the late 60s as being committed to disarming itself of nuclear weapons. Has not really done that in any kind of a consistent way. There have been some steps in that direction. Reagan, near the end of his rule, reduced a number of weapons with Russia. Then there was the START II treaty, and then the renewal of the START II treaty that Obama just signed with Russia a few weeks ago, that still needs to be ratified by the Senate, that would have some further reduction. But there's still some 23,000 of these nukes around the world. The good news coming out of this summit is that Ukraine, which had, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, renounced its nuclear stockpile, now also renounced the enriched uranium stockpile that it's had and agreed to turn that over to the United States. So one less nuclear power, or in this case, nuclear capable power out there. There are still many more to go, of course. And in fact, we've added, four nuclear powers since the NPT was put into force. Those being, three, technically, Israel, India, and North Korea, Pakistan, India, North Korea. And then Israel has been a nuclear power, but has refused to acknowledge whether it is or not, for all that time as well. If there is going to be any meaningful move toward abolition at this conference at the UN in May, Obama is going to have to not just take leadership on the United States reducing its stockpile, but also demand that the world's nuclear powers issue into multilateral negotiations for ridding the world of all nuclear weapons, and that includes the United States pressuring Israel to remove its, because as long as Israel has that stockpile, both Iran and any number of other Arab states around the Middle East are also going to want their own nuclear stockpiles. It's not just Iran. There's nuclear programs now underway in Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and several other Arab states, the Gulf states as well.
And then when the U.S. takes in this highly enriched uranium from the Ukraine, where does that go in the U.S.?
That's an excellent question. I don't know if it goes to Hanford or where it actually physically winds up. We have both the nation's leading repository for low-level nuclear waste in Hanford, and then, of course, 15 air miles from Seattle, we also have the country's largest stockpile of the actual nuclear weapons, which is the Trident Nuclear. Of course, most of those are out to sea at any given time, but they're based at the Trident Nuclear, the Bangor Nuclear Subbase in Kitsap County in Poulsbo, just west of here.
Yeah, I think they keep plenty of reloads there at the base. So
I'm sure they do, because you never have enough.
All right. Events.
On the other hand, you know, nuclear winter makes a great solution to global warming. Yeah. Sorry, and we were doing so well with the good news. Today, 9 o'clock registration, and from 10 until 4 o'clock, the Western Washington Fellowship of Reconciliation is having its spring assembly. Come hear great speakers and all sorts of good strategizing about issues around peace and social justice. That will be at Fauntleroy United Church of Christ, 9260 California Avenue Southwest, over in West Seattle. And if you have not pre-registered, you can just bop over there this morning and check it out. I'm sure they'll be happy to see you. Tuesday night, Bill McKibben, the environmentalist and an activist and author, will be at Town Hall at 7:30. And then Friday at 7 o'clock, a film called Nicholsville has been made, and you'll never guess what the topic is. It's about Nicholsville. The premiere of that film is going to be showing at a benefit for, you guessed it, Nicholsville. That'll be this Friday night at University Congregational United Church of Christ. That's at 4515 16th Avenue in the University District. Again, Friday at 7 p.m. this coming week.
Very good. Talking with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news and opinion and humor and all the rest of it. The current issue is web only. It's up now on our website at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, want to respond to anything that you hear on this show, or suggest topics that can be covered on other shows, email us. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.